Hey, so as many of you know, I spent about a decade in the marketplace before I became a professional Christian. I did not in any way grow up thinking I would have this job. I grew up in local churches and didn't really get along with the pastors, which makes this really ironic for me. And so in the marketplace, if you work in the business community, or maybe you have been in that world before, like I was, you know that every year you do these things called annual performance reviews. And for a lot of people, it's like a scary time because bonuses and raises and things like that kind of hinge on how well your performance review goes. But when I walked into my very first performance review, I was kind of like Angela from The Office. I was really excited about it because I felt like that my body of work was going to hold up pretty well to the scrutiny of it. And so I walked in and sat down, and the guy across from me was a partner in this consulting firm that I was working in. And he said, "Hey, Gavin, you've been really great over the last year. In fact, I kind of gave you high marks on everything. Here's a bonus and here's a raise." And I remember thinking, we should do this every week. Like, I love these performance reviews. This is fantastic. And so when I transitioned out of the marketplace and, you know, into ministry, my first job was at Southside Church. Chris Patton is a lead pastor there. He took a risk and hired a business guy to run middle school ministry. And I was, for the most part, a part-time, bivocational middle school pastor. That was like my first Christian job. And I remember after several months, he said, "Hey, we're going to do a performance review." And I kind of chuckled and thought, "Oh yeah, really? This is going to be tough because, like, I just worked at a massive consulting company. You know, we served Fortune 100 clients. I like hung out with CEOs for a while. And so, to be honest, I'm not that worried about your performance review and this little churchy thing that we're doing." And so I remember I walked into this performance review. The process was kind of fun. He gave me a document. He had one too. They were identical. And it had a bunch of characteristics on it that you would rate yourself 1 to 5 on. And, you know, 1 is like basically how do you still have a job? And 5 is best I've ever seen. You know, that's kind of how the scale worked. And so I remember going through that list and I had to fill it out for myself. And I put 5, 5, 5. And I mean, honestly, it was kind of easy to put 5s because we were, as a church, killing it. I was doing a great job as a part-time middle school pastor. I mean, it just, you know, it was pretty good. So I looked at my document and I realized that I had like pretty much all 5s and everything. So I went back and erased some of them, put 4s, you know, because of humility and stuff. And so I did that. Well, Chris had the same document and he filled it out kind of how he thought about me. And the process is that we would go together for like a lunch or something, and then we would both kind of compare and contrast our documents. We would look at how he scored me, I would look at how I scored me, and then we would decide, you know, who was right, and it was probably going to be me. And so we kind of were going to go through that process. And so we went to lunch, and we sat down, and we pulled our little sheets out, and we started looking at the sheets, and Chris actually gave me more 5s than I gave myself. If I remember, Chris only had a couple of 4s on the whole thing. And I thought, wow, I was more humble than you were, Chris. Like, I had way more 4s than you. You know, they weren't real 4s, but they were 4s. So I remember thinking at the end, well, this was easy. Like, we should do this every week. It's kind of how I felt in the marketplace. And then he said something that kind of stopped me in my tracks. He said, "Gavin," he said, "the problem is that you know that you're a 5 out of 5. That's the problem. Like, the problem isn't that you have 5s. The problem is that you know that you're a 5 out of 5. And people who know that they're a 5 out of 5 struggle with this thing called pride. And you got to figure out how to be more humble in ministry." Chris told me, he said, I've observed you now for, you know, 6 months or so. And here's what I've seen. I've seen people who don't want to compliment you anymore because they think your head is barely fitting through the door frame. Now, if it gets any bigger, you're not going to make it inside the church. So I can't compliment you. And I've watched people not even want to critique things because every time we see something that could be better and we come to you with it, your response is, "Oh yeah, I already know about that. Here's what we're doing to fix it. It won't happen again. Thanks for telling me." He said, "If you don't figure out this humility thing, it's going to be really, really tough for you because you are going to limit what God can do in you and mostly what he can do through you if you don't become a little more humble." So I remember walking away from that performance review. It was the first time I ever walked away from one thinking, wow, that didn't go like I thought it was going to go. Because in the marketplace, the things that I was doing made you president, got you to partner status, right? But in ministry, it just was different. I didn't know that. So I started studying humility. I'm like, well, how do you become humble? Like, what do you do to be humble? Is it like a prayer? Do you spin around? Do you stand your head the right way? Like, do you go to a retreat? Are there nuns involved? Like, I don't know. Like, how do you become humble? It seemed really hard. I read some books about it. I talked to some people who appeared humble. Really, they were just boring. And so I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do with any of this stuff. I'm not kidding. I met one guy who seemed humble. And then after the end, I thought, well, no wonder he's humble. He's never done anything worth being prideful about. I guess, is that the answer? I'm just being honest, you know? And so here's what I decided to do. In consulting, if anybody ever came to you and said, "Hey, can you solve this problem?" The answer is always yes. even if you don't know how, because you figure it out. That's what consultants do. Oh yeah, I can fix that for you. And then you go, how do you fix this? So I thought, maybe I should do the same thing with humility. Maybe I should just fake it until I make it. And that's what I started doing. I just started faking humility. In fact, I adopted some catchphrases. I started every conversation with, I might be wrong, but, or this may be a bad idea, but, and the reality is I knew I wasn't wrong and I knew it was a great idea. But if I started this way, it made me look way more humble. So I would go into meetings and we would talk about ideas and I would listen for a few minutes. Then we'd go, hey, this may be a bad idea, but what if we did it this way? Everybody would go, oh, wow, that's a really good idea. And I would say, really? I had no idea. I'm so humble. I didn't know that. That's amazing, you know? Or like I would say, I might be wrong about what I saw, but what if we changed and did it this way? And they go, oh my gosh, that's an amazing thing. We should change that. I'm like, wow, I thought I was wrong, but maybe I wasn't. Look how humble I am. So I did that for years. Those kind of catchphrases, they just became a part of my normal vocabulary. And several years into this faking it, I didn't feel any different. But I thought people around me probably saw me a little differently because the phrases were probably working. So I decided to opt into a new kind of review. I did this thing called a 360 review. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. I would never encourage you to do it. A 360 review means you have people all around you anonymously review you. Your boss kind of reviews you. Your peers review you. The people who work for you review you. And then just friends and maybe your spouse, people like that. And it's all anonymous. So they say whatever they want and they never hold back, which is why I wouldn't encourage you to do it. And so I went into it though feeling good because I've been working on the catchphrases and I've been working on being humble. And so I thought this is going to be a lot better than it would have been a few years ago. So I did this 360 review and I got the results back. And as I was looking through the results, there's this one word that kept coming out, came out multiple times. It was the word hubris. Now, I didn't know what hubris was. It sounded like humility. I thought maybe this is a good thing. And so I looked up the word hubris and here's what hubris means. Excessive pride or self-confidence. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like these catchphrases are making it worse. Like I'm trying so hard to be humble and I don't feel different, but I'm trying really hard and now I'm excessively not humble. And I'm trying not to come across as being too confident. And now I'm like excessively self-confident. This is the opposite direction. Like it really kind of messed me up. It threw me for a loop. I've been working really hard on this and I'm obviously not making any progress. I'm going backwards, in fact. So I decided that I had to have a new solution. So my new solution was I was gonna start replicating what I saw being rewarded in other people. Because there were other people I was working with, they participated in my 360. Some of the other lead pastors in our kind of network did. And I would watch them and I would think, man, maybe if I behaved and acted more like those guys, maybe hubris wouldn't be my definition anymore. And so like one of my best friends, Jeff Henderson, I love that guy. Jeff, he's the lead pastor at Gwinnett Church. Super encouraging, man. Like he is so positive and encouraging. And so I thought, well, I should just be more like Jeff. So I started hugging people a lot more. It was weird, but you know, I thought maybe that's what I should do. Maybe hubris people don't hug and I can be a hugger. That'll solve some of this. So I started hugging more. And then I saw my friend Clay Scroggins. Clay leads at North Point Community Church. I love Clay, man. He and I are real good buddies. And I watch Clay. He is super positive, man. Like no matter what's happening, the building is burning down. He's like, man, look how beautiful those flames are, you know? And he's like so positive, man. He's so positive. And he's funny. He's so witty. I've never been around Clay where he didn't make me laugh. And I thought, well, maybe I should be more funny and more positive. Like I'm super sarcastic. That sometimes is funny, sometimes not so funny. And so maybe I should hone in on the funny part of that and be really positive. Even though God didn't seem to make me that positive, but maybe I can be more like Clay. And that'll get rid of hubris. And there was this guy named Joel Thomas. He worked at North Point. He now leads a church in Arizona, Mission Community Church. Joel is incredible. He's a really cool soul patch. I love this guy, Joel. And so Joel was so well connected. He knew everybody. Like when somebody said, hey, I met Jim. And he was like, oh, Jim and I are best friends. We had lunch last week. And I'm like, Joel, how do you know everybody here? Like you are so well connected. You're so relational. Maybe I should be more like you because that seems to be a thing that's being rewarded. I don't think people are calling you hubris. They seem to like you. So maybe I should be more like you. And so that's what I started doing. In fact, for a pretty long span of time, I tried to become more funny like Clay and positive. I tried to hug more people like Jeff. I tried to be more relationally connected like Joel. And what happened didn't help me with the problem. It actually began to make it worse because I started looking around. I was so focused on other people that I lost focus on me. Have you ever been in that place before? Like you kind of lose sight of who you are. lose sight of who you kind of could be, when you're constantly focused on who you weren't meant to be. And that's kind of where I was living. I was so hyper-focused on who I might be able to be, so focused on who I could potentially be, that I completely lost focus on who I actually was meant to be. It was a really kind of tough season. I found myself completely not confident as a leader. I felt myself really not confident as a speaker. I wasn't confident in public. Like, if you and I would have bumped into each other several years ago, like in downtown, you know, Woodstock or something, and you were like, hey, Gavin, I would have wanted to run the other way because I just didn't feel confident in the position that God had placed me in. I didn't feel very confident at home. Man, I really just felt constantly judged. And what's interesting about it is when I thought about how I felt internally, you know, the word hubris kept coming back up, but hubris is excessive pride or excessive self-confidence. As I felt myself, I didn't feel anything confident. In fact, I felt the opposite of self-confidence. I didn't feel confident at all. I didn't feel prideful at all. I felt like I was just faking everything, faking as a leader, faking as a pastor, trying to prove that I belonged. What's interesting is that those are actually presenting symptoms of a deeper problem. Now, we've been saying in this conversation that adulting is hard, not because of taxes and jobs and all that. Adulting is hard because of that icky stuff that lives really deep in our heart and affects us all in different ways. And this is what was happening to me. There was this virus that was kind of settling deep in my heart, and it was affecting me in a way that looked like pride and looked like overly confident and looked like arrogance. But like all viruses, they can present differently in different people. Right, sometimes a virus makes you sneeze. Sometimes it makes you vomit. Sometimes it makes your friend cough and it makes you have a sore throat. It's how it presents. And we typically deal with the symptoms of the virus without actually knowing what the virus is. And the symptoms of this virus are pretty widespread. Like for some of you like me, maybe the symptoms look like kind of being overly confident or arrogant. But that's just one way that it shows up. I mean, it can look like a bully. People who bully others often suffer from this virus. That's just the presenting symptom. People who are know-it-alls typically have the same virus in their heart. There's people who refuse to help. That's how it presents in some people. If you're a boss, maybe you're a micromanager as a boss. That's a part of maybe the virus presenting in you. Some people present it as being indecisive, afraid to make decisions. Or maybe you're just overly concerned about your self-image. You're constantly worried about how people see you or how they think about you or what they say about you. People who have this virus may avoid conflict of any kind because they're just not going to deal with conflict because of that thing in you doesn't make you want to. You strive to prove yourself to others and even prove yourself to yourself. The virus causes some of us to do that. It can cause you to take credit for other people's accomplishments. It can cause you to be afraid. This virus can present as jealousy or envy. It could present as being very judgmental. It could present as being very hypocritical. I mean, I could go on and on, but you get the point, right? It's a weird thing how a virus can present in so many different ways. And my guess is that every single one of us has a version of that presentation in our heart. And the reason is because you're an adult, and it's a part of what being an adult feels like sometimes. It's part of what makes adulting hard. And it doesn't mean that your entire life is defined by one of those things. It does mean that that presenting symptom is probably present in your life from time to time. Now, the good news is about this virus. We can actually name this virus. It has a name. It goes by something you've probably all heard of. Insecurity. That's the real virus. And insecurity is a really nasty virus because it presents in so many difficult ways, and it's hard to know what the real problem is. Because the virus is insecurity, but the symptoms don't really look like that. That was a part of my problem. Here's kind of what insecurity is. I love this definition. Insecurity is when we aren't comfortable being who we are because we are consumed with who we aren't. That's what insecurity is. Insecurity is when we're just not comfortable being who we really are because we are so consumed with trying to become who we aren't. That was really my problem. I wasn't dealing with pride. I wasn't dealing with overly self-confidence or arrogance. That was just a mask. It was a camouflage for the actual virus, for the actual problem. And the problem was insecurity. Once I learned that, it kind of led me on a new learning path. It kind of led me to start solving a different problem. Because the problem wasn't become more humble. The problem was figure out why you're so insecure. So one of the first things I did was open up the Bible and start looking at biblical characters, trying to find somebody who dealt with insecurity to see what they did or what God did with them. And there's no, you know, character in the Bible who, you know, at any point goes, and I was insecure, read this story, it will help you. I mean, it wasn't that clear. But as I started looking at different people, I came across one person who seemed to suffer from some of the same symptoms that I was suffering from, at least on a similar way, but it played out differently. It's a guy named King David. Now, when you think about King David, you know, you've all heard of King David. And you may not have heard of King David, but you've heard of David, David and Goliath. That's the same David. And when you think about David, and you think about his story, you know, the things that we know about him don't really reek of insecurity. I mean, there was a moment that probably was birthed out of insecurity. You remember the moment he's standing up on the palace and he looks out and he sees like this beautiful woman and she's, you know, kind of bathing or whatever. And he's like, yeah, I would like to have some of that. Bring her to me. And so, you know, the guards bring her up and he has an affair with her. Well, I mean, and you know this, right? Almost all affairs are birthed out of some version of insecurity. That's why those things often happen. But then he realizes that he's not just messed up now. This is going to cause a bigger problem because this girl, Bathsheba, is married. So he puts Bathsheba's husband on the front lines of the battle so that he'll be killed. So that way it reduces the problem. I don't know that murder stems from insecurity, but maybe it does. But he also was a man after God's own heart, which means that he figured out the security thing at some point. He was able to navigate it. It's so fascinating when you begin to look at the backstory of King David. It's so evident how insecurity began to become birthed in his heart. In fact, I'm going to look a little bit at his backstory with you for a minute. And I think we're going to learn a lot about how it manifests in our heart as well. Now, to read about his story, you turn to 1 Samuel. Samuel was a prophet, kind of God's mouthpiece for the nation of Israel. He had some really great things to say that God said through him. Saul was the very first king of Israel, and Saul was like a 1 out of 5 on the performance review scale. He was a terrible king. He was terrible. He was the worst anybody had ever seen. And so God realized that he had to replace Saul, and he was going to do that with one of Jesse's sons. And so Samuel is sent to go figure out who it's going to be. So this is 1 Samuel. We're going to begin in chapter 16, verse 1. The Lord said to Samuel, the prophet, how long will you mourn for Saul since I have rejected him as king over Israel? He basically says, hey, by the way, you know that Saul is not going to be the king anymore. I need you to quit mourning about it. I need you to go do something about it. Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I am sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen, he continues, I have chosen one of his sons to be the king. Now, this is so cool because we don't really fill horns with oil and march off to people's houses, but that's what Samuel did. And Jesse had no idea that he was coming. And so when they show up, if you read the whole story, when the prophet Samuel shows up, Jesse's like, whoa, why are you here? Because if you're about to prophesy against me, just turn yourself around and go back because I don't want any of that. And I don't want your oil horn either, right? And so Samuel comes up and says, no. God is going to replace Saul as the king, and one of your sons is going to be the king. And so Jesse goes, oh, well, that's good news. So the lineage of Saul isn't where the king's going to come from, huh? God's chosen me, he's chosen our family. Well, that's fantastic. I have a lot of sons. So he gets his sons, and he lines his sons up in front of Samuel. It's like a parade of men for Samuel, so he can pick out the one that he thinks is going to be the next king of Israel. And so this is great. This is how the story continues. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, surely this is the Lord's anointed. He stands before the Lord because look at his name. That's a perfect king name, right? And look at his body. Look how tall he is, how strong he is, how good looking he is. Like, this is the firstborn of Jesse. The firstborn always gets the best stuff. This has to be the next king of Israel. So Samuel begins to almost anoint him. He almost begins to go through the process, and God stops him. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. And then he drops this big truth on Samuel and on us. The Lord does not look at the things that people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Isn't that true? Like this is a part of our insecurity problem. Remember how we defined insecurity? We said insecurity is when we aren't comfortable with who we are because we're just consumed with who we aren't. See, this whole idea of not being comfortable with who we are, I could write it over here. Who we are is our real self. That's who we are. And we kind of know who we are. That's our real self. But when we become consumed with who we aren't, we develop what we're going to call an ideal self. And this ideal self comes from several different places. It comments create this version. Comparison creates this ideal self. And if you think about kind of David in this moment, this is kind of what's happening. There's this whole line of people, and there's comparisons and there's comments. And this is how it's happened for you and I too. See, we begin by knowing who we are. That's our real self. And maybe we don't know as much as we should know, but we know enough to know that it's not who we wish we were. And we grow up in this world where we're constantly hearing comments about us. We're constantly hearing comparisons about us because we live in a world where people see the surface. We live in a world where people compare and comment all the time. And we take those things in because we're people too. And we recognize that the real us isn't good enough, but the ideal us seems way better. And maybe if we could become the ideal us, the comments would go away. And maybe the comparisons would feel better if we could just become this ideal person. The problem is that the real you and the ideal you aren't the same you. And when these two things get together, it creates almost like an insecurity sandwich. And it will eat you alive. In fact, this comparison of the real you and the ideal you is where insecurity breeds. It's where the virus grows. And it gets really difficult to deal with the more we live in this ideal versus real. So keep that in mind as the story continues, because you're about to see something in David's heart that's really significant. So he asked Jesse, Samuel asked Jesse, "Are these all the sons that you have?" Because we just went through the parade of sons, and God said no to every single one of them. You know, Samuel's wondering if he heard God wrong. Jesse's wondering if Samuel heard God wrong. So Jesse responds. He says, "Well, they're still the youngest," he answered. "He's tending the sheep. His name's David. In fact, he's not even worth coming to the sun parade. Like, he's the youngest. He's not even, I mean, he's barely getting by as a shepherd. Why in the world would I even bring him in? In fact, Samuel, when you came to me and said one of your sons is going to be the king, I lined up everybody who I thought it could be. I didn't even call for David. There's no way it's going to be him. He's the youngest. He's just a shepherd. No one thinks about that. No one thinks about him." Now, can you imagine how that must have felt to David? I doubt this is the first time he's ever been overlooked. I doubt it's the first time his dad has ever compared him that way or ever said things about him that caused him to wonder about his real self versus his ideal self. My guess, reading between the lines, is that this was a real insecure moment for David. And I bet he had grown up with some festering insecurity because of the way that he was treated, maybe his entire life. Some of you can absolutely agree with that, can't you? Some of you have felt that. Like, some of you grew up with a dad who was like Jesse, who always liked the other kids better, at least you felt that way, and he never really treated you the way you thought that he should have, and it festered insecurity in your heart, and you've been living out of that ever since. That's where David is at. Now, check out the way the story continues. He says, so he sent for him, and he had him brought in. David finally comes to the parade of sons. He was glowing with health and had a fine appearance and handsome features, which I think is so funny that this got included in scripture. It's almost like Samuel went, "I just can't get past his looks. Like, I know I'm supposed to look deeper. God, you look at the heart, but I can't do that. Look how good looking he is," you know? Like, he still couldn't get past it. And God knew that Samuel couldn't get past that. And God knew that Jesse couldn't get past it. And God knew what it was doing to David's heart that they couldn't get past it. So here's what God says. He says, the Lord said, "Rise and anoint him. This is the one." David, the youngest. Jesse, the one that you didn't think was worthy of being in the parade. Samuel, the one that you can't imagine being the next king. Yeah, anoint him. He is the one. I think this is a moment where things change dramatically for David. In fact, if you read one more chapter after this, The entire nation of Israel is freaking out because the Philistines are on the other side of the valley, and a giant named Goliath is in the valley cursing and yelling at the Israelites and making fun of God and all this stuff. And he keeps saying, just send one person down here to fight me, and not a single one of them would go. Until David, the shepherd, showed up without any armor and said, give me a few rocks. Like, can you imagine how much security it would take to do that? I think it takes the kind of security from a person who decided that this was good enough because God said it was. And that he wasn't going to be worried about comments and comparisons anymore. Because the ideal self wasn't the real David, and he didn't need the ideal David. He was perfectly fine with who God said he was. And he went on to defeat Goliath, and he went on to become the king of Israel. And as king, he wrote a bunch of stuff. He wrote a lot of the book of Psalms in our Old Testament. One of the coolest things about Psalms is that you can look at the things that David wrote and in some ways trace it back to his experiences before he was king. And in fact, Psalm 139 is just one of those. In fact, I've always wondered if David wrote Psalm 139 thinking about this moment when his dad overlooked him and when Samuel couldn't imagine that he had what it took and all the insecurity that was probably festering in his heart during that. Here's what David wrote, Psalm 139. For you, talking about God, for you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, including the real me. I know that full well. Like, I wonder how much of the struggles that David had early on dealt with insecurity. And I wonder how much of that's true for us too. Like, I wonder how much that virus is festering in our hearts, making adulting almost impossible because we're just so tied up with the comments and we're so connected to the comparisons that we've idealized and romanticized this version of us. God doesn't want you to romanticize the ideal you. He just wants you to personalize the real you that he created. See, that's kind of the secret behind this. So when you think about your ideal self, we create that. Like, this whole ideal self is all our creation. We're the ones who makes that. But this real you, the real you, God created it. And he created it to be amazing. He created it just like David said. The real you that God created, he created exactly as he wanted to. The real you is who God wants you to really be. And he doesn't want you romanticizing something that you aren't. He really wants you to personalize who you are. He wants you to live out of who you are, live out of that real self, the real healthy version of who you are. And it's really critical that we learn that because it's what begins to get rid of that insecurity virus in our heart. I mean, here's the truth about this. It is impossible. It is impossible to be secure in who God made you to be if you are disappointed with who God didn't make you to be. You become disappointed with yourself. Maybe even worse, you become disappointed with God. You become disappointed with God because you think he could have done better. He could have made you better. But God made you, at least David believes, exactly the way he wanted to. That David believed that God didn't make mistakes, that he made trees the way he wanted, he made bugs the way he wanted, he made you exactly the way he wanted, that he knit you together in your mother's womb. Everything about you, your height, your skin color, your preferences, your passions, your abilities, your skills, everything. Everything in health of that is the real you that God created. And I think he wants you to live out of that. And I think that's how we begin to rid our hearts of insecurity, when we recognize that's a good thing that God created. Now, when you begin to recognize the real you, now this isn't like permission to go, well, God made me a jerk, so I'm gonna be a tool. Like, that's not... Okay, that isn't what David meant. Like, he meant that you could let go of the negative stuff, that you could let go of all the comments that you've been storing up in your heart for years and years and years. You can let go of all the comparisons that you've been living in for years and years. Some that you created, a lot that were created for you. Why can't you be more like? Why can't you be better? Those are the things that create this ideal self. And God's going, you got to forget all that. Let go of the comments and let go of those comparisons and cling to what I have created. Grab a hold of what I have created, the real you, the real you, who is completely wonderful and knit together exactly the way that I want you to be. Now, to move towards that, it takes some time. It isn't like an overnight thing. Like, you don't walk out of, you know, church on Sunday going, oh my gosh, no more ideal me. Like, I can just be the real me. I mean, I wish it was that easy. But you know, like, getting rid of a virus takes time, right? Like, getting rid of a virus isn't easy. It's disgusting. It takes a lot of sneezing and coughing, and there's some projectile vomiting. And that's how this works too. Like, to get rid of the insecurity in you, it's been breeding for years in your heart. So for you to get rid of it, it's going to take some time. But I do think it's possible. I think there's a way to do it. And the reason I feel confident saying that is because for a long time, I've been trying to do it. And I'm not all the way there yet, but I'm way closer now than I was years ago. And part of that process for me was answering some really tough questions, but they're really clarifying questions. In fact, I'd love to just share four of those questions with you. And maybe as I read them, you can just think about how you would answer them and how your real versus ideal self may play out in these answers. The first question is just so simple. Who were you as a child? Did you know that you were probably at your most real when you were little? Because when you're a little kid, now, not all of us, some of us had some really bad upbringing stuff. But when you were 3, when you were 4, when you were 5, like, you weren't so concerned about the comments yet. You didn't even know that you should compare your car to other people's cars yet. You were just you. And at your best, you were fully you. This is why you can walk into a preschool classroom and you can ask the class, how many of you are creative? You know how many 4-year-olds will raise their hand? All of them. If you take that exact same group of kids, ask them that exact question in 5th grade, guess how many raise their hand? Hardly any. You know why? Because of comments and because of comparisons. They've lost who they really are. And you're an adult. You've lost that too, on some level. Who were you as a kid? Who were you before the comments and comparisons created insecurity in God's creation? I'll tell you who I was. I was an artist, and I was a creator, and I was a competitor. That's how I was. When I was little, I loved to create. I would go in my room for hours, like 5-6 hours at a time, and draw. I was a cartoonist for a long time. I did that. I loved to compete in stuff. Like, me and my friends would pour Legos in the ground, and we would make guns out of Legos because we're boys. I think that's what you're supposed to do. I'm telling you, I vividly remember thinking, I don't care if I get the best pieces. I don't have to have the best gun. And then the minute they were poured out, all of that thinking was gone. Because God made me competitive. And there's a really healthy side of that. There's a really unhealthy part of it too. But there's a healthy part of it. So who were you as a kid? It's a really important question to answer. Let me give you another one. Who are you when you were at your best? And where do you excel when you're at your best? Like, when you are your most healthy, who are you? Where do you excel when you're the most healthy? For me, the answer is pretty easy too. I excel best when I'm dealing with creation and ideas and innovations. Like, I'm really not great at maintaining things. God didn't make me to be a maintainer. He did some of you though, and we need maintainers because we can't just always be creating something and thinking about the future. We're like, we need somebody who can actually do things right now. But that's not who God made me to be. Like, I started thinking deeply about that question. And I'm absolutely at my best when I'm in idea meetings. That's when I'm at my best. I've tried to spend way more time in those meetings the last several years because that's how God fearfully and wonderfully made me. Here's another question. Are you seeking to become the healthy you or an unhealthy replica of someone else? Are you trying to become the healthy you, or are you trying to be an unhealthy version of you by replicating somebody else? I already told you about that answer for me. Oh my gosh, I spent so much time trying to be somebody else instead of just being who God actually made me to be. Here's the last question. What in your heart is holding you back? That's a big one, isn't it? What's really holding you back? I'll tell you one thing for me, it was fear. Fear was holding me back. I was afraid that if I just acted like the real me, that everybody wouldn't like it. I was afraid that if I kind of threw out this ideal self and just started living out of the real self, that it wouldn't be good enough. And I was afraid of that. Because the real me is still an artist. And the real me is still kind of innovative. And the real me is kind of subversive. I don't love status quo anything. In fact, if you tell me this is how we always do it, I think we should change it just because. That's just how God made me. I grew up as a skater. I love skateboarding. If you go into my office right now, I've got skateboard decks hanging all over the walls. And they actually look kind of satanic, which is weird for a pastor. But I love skateboarding. Like, I love skating. So I walk into my office now and I see skateboards. You know why I hung them up there? It's an everyday reminder of who I actually am. That's the real me. It's the real me. And it's a reminder that I can't let fear dictate who I have to be. That's how I would answer those questions. But what about you? I think those are really important ways to start dealing with what's in our hearts. And maybe the very first thing we should do is what David did. Maybe we should even pray Psalm 139 as a prayer for us and for our hearts. So that's actually how I want to end today. If you remember what David said, he believed that God knit you together in your mother's womb. He believes that you were fearfully and wonderfully made, that everything God has done is exactly the way he wants it, and you are perfect. You are perfect. If you could begin to live out of that truth, it has the power to change everything in your insecure adult heart. So can we just pray that together? I'm gonna put it on the screen, and I'd love for us just to say this out loud as a prayer when it comes to our heart and where we're at with who we are. All right, let's just say this together. Say, Heavenly Father, I believe you created my inmost being. Let's start over. This is really important. This is a really important thing. Let's say it all together. Don't repeat. This isn't a wedding vow. This is a true prayer, okay? All joking aside, though, I think it's worth starting over because this is a really big deal. And when David wrote this, it was a part of what changed his heart and what changed his life. I think he can do the same for you and for me. So let's just all say it together. Sound good? Here we go. Heavenly Father, I believe you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. Do you know that full well? Because that's what God thinks about you. And the minute you begin to believe that's true, is the minute that virus starts leaving your heart and you get to be the person God actually created you to be.